Everybody say hello to Bob. Bob is where I'm staying in Idaho.
Hello, Bob.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
And Tamar is there as well.
Hi.
Hi, Tamar.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Please join me in saying
hi, Tamar.
Anabakoa Gedulachamincha Tati Zerura Alabet Gimel Yotzat Zadi Kaberinat Amcha Sagveinu Tahareinu No ra tu fresh ayin sinchet dun na yibor dor shehud cha kevavat shamrem nun gimondalet yud kav shin barchem tacharem Rachamei Siddhkatha Tami Gamlem Betet Resh Sadi Tav Gimel. The letter Kaf that created the planet we call the Sun, which has two names in Hebrew, the external name Chatan and the internal name Shemesh. Chatan means hot, and it relates to the way Leo people treat others when they're not doing their spiritual path. They will tend to tell everybody what's right, what's wrong, what to do, but in a way that the person isn't ready to hear it, and it tends to burn the person out from the heat of the sun. And the Shemesh, which means servant, when the Leo people have followed a spiritual path, when they have learned to be the servant that the sun actually is, its internal essence, wanting to share with no expectation in return. So they'll tell people what they need to do, to know, but in a way that the person can hear it. And the Tets that created the constellation Aryeh, the lion that is connected to the concept of mercy, the lion that is connected to the 72 names of God, the lion that is connected to the womb, as the Tet looks like a womb. And while the pregnancy takes 9 months, during the month of Av, it's shortened to be 9 days, from the first to the ninth. This is the essence of the balance of the 3 week period, that of the pregnancy. Chasin kadosh berotucha na'ayla adata het kuf bet het nunayin. Yachid ge'e lamcha b'chem zok rei kedusha taf yud gimel lamed bezay taf bezay and kuf. I knew it was wrong. Shabbateinu kavel u'shma tziyakatinu Yodea Talumot Shinkufav Sadiyotav. In the eighth verse we say in a whisper, there is no Zohar during the 3 weeks, so I'm going to read from a section of Ki Tetzeh, because it's the book that I happened to open. Vayihino am Adonai Eloheinu aleinu ma'aseh yadeinu kudanei aleinu ma'aseh yadeinu kudaneihu. V'zim na'adetani na'in mare mishna it pechon v'chaloket umakshin da dida balat lechavre v'haihu talmid zer shelo higia lechorah. Umore hayav mita vehidun shavinda dedat leda vehit bechon machalot get lekushya itmar bechon lesof veet vahav besufa veyuknuha ha'ahba besofa. When the crocodiles, the Mishnah sages, have a disagreement among them and ask each other difficult questions, one then swallows his colleague like the fish of the sea, where the bigger swallows the smaller. This concerns a younger student who has not reached the position of teaching, yet teaches, which is punishable by death. But if they are on equal footing, both being large, and have a disagreement and difficult question, it says of them at the end, Vaheben Sufa, which has been explained to mean love at its end, since Vahev means love, Ahava, and Sufa means end. This is discussing, this section, why fish and locusts do not require slaughtering. And it's using the fish as a metaphor for human beings in their Torah study. The Mishnah sages are those people who wrote the Talmud, and how they deal with each other in their process. And it's indicating if you don't have permission to teach, it's a problem. And if you are asking questions from the standpoint of an ego level, instead of wanting to truly find out the answer, it also creates problems. But ultimately, people will arrive at this concept of love in the end, which is what the end of days will lead to. Are there any questions? I do have one announcement before I forget. I forgot to mention it Monday night. The 7 o'clock class is too close to the start of Tisha B'Av. So I am going to cancel that class, and we'll pick it up the following week. So I just wanted you to be aware of that. Okay, I am starting to read where we left off in the last class. In section 20 of chapter 1, we had not finished that section. And then we'll be going to the inner light, or the commentary on the inner light that Rabbi Ashlag has written. We should ask, since we have no attainment in En Sof, how then do we know him by name? After all, each name designates the attainment that we attain in him, according to the definition of that name. We cannot excuse ourselves by saying that the name merely points to the negation of attainment, for then we should have named him unattainable. The thing is that the name indicates the entire difference between En Sof and all the Alamot, all the worlds beneath it. The Tzimtzum took place after En Sof. Thus, in every place this force awakens, it restricts the light, and that ends the Heara in that place. Hence, any Soph and Siyum in any Heara, in any Partsu, comes solely from the Tzimtzum. Any end, any beginning, and any impression in any Partsuf is a complete structure of Sephirot, comes solely from the Tzimtzum. Moreover, all the beings and their various fillings in the worlds come about and are innervated because of that end and beginning. It is called Ein Sof because the Tzimtzum does not apply there, indicating that there isn't any ending there whatsoever. With that, we can deduce that this light is Pashut, simple, and completely even, for one depends on the other. What Rabbi Ashlag is saying, or what the Ari is saying, and Rabbi Ashlag is commenting on, we call it Ein Sof, endless. But we really can't attain it. We have no ability to sense what is going on there. As we know, there's no disappearance in spirituality. So the Ein Sof still exists. We are still there. But through the curtain and through the process of the Tzimtzum, actually, we have no ability to sense what's happening there. And so the question is, if we can't sense it, how can we name it? And we cannot name something that we truly cannot attain. And that's the question being asked. And Rabbi Ashlag is coming to this conclusion that the light must be simple, it must be even, in order for us to be able to name endless. The fact that we can't sense it does not mean we can't attain it, because there's never a change in the endless world. And that's the paradox of the Tzimtzum as well, because we know we're going to come from the endless world to our world, and then after correction we're going to eventually return to the endless world. And if there was no change, what is the purpose of this world? And all of these paradoxical questions are implied in these paragraphs that I just read. And we will discuss them more as we go through the teaching. Are there any questions before I go to the histachlut pnimit, the inner light?
Pnimit.
Say again, Chris, I couldn't hear.
I was just thinking about what you had just said, where you're going next. I was trying to remember where my material was on that.
Well, it's on a website that I'm reading from, so you're welcome to know where that is. It's Kabbalah.info, which is the B'nai Baruch group.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar.
And then
correct.
The library, and then you go to the Baal HaSulam, and then to the 10 luminous emanations. And we're in part one of chapter one, titled Tzimtzum and Kav, chapter one. We just finished that. So now we're in the inner reflection, which is all of Rabbi Ashlag's commentary. First, you must know that when dealing with spiritual matters, that have no concern with time, space, and motion. And moreover, when dealing with godliness, we do not have the words by which to express and contemplate. Our entire vocabulary is taken from sensations of imaginary senses. Thus, how can they assist us where sense and imagination do not reign? For example, if you take the subtlest of words, namely orot, lights, it nonetheless resembles and borrows from the light of the sun or an emotional light of satisfaction. Thus, how can they be used to express godly matters? They would certainly fail to provide the reader with anything true. It is even truer in a place where these words should disclose the negotiations in the wisdom in print. As it is done in any research of wisdom, if we fail with even a single inadequate word, the reader will be instantly disoriented and will not find his hands and legs in this entire matter. For that reason, the sages of the Kabbalah have chosen a special language, which we can call the language of the branches. There is not an essence or a conduct in this world that does not begin in its shoresh in the upper world. Moreover, the beginning of every being in this world starts from the upper world and then hangs down to this world. Thus, the sages have found an adequate language without trouble by which they could convey their attainments to each other by word of mouth and in writing from generation to generation. They have taken the names of the branches in this world, where each name is self-explanatory, as though pointing to its upper shoresh, its upper root, in the system of the upper worlds. That should appease your mind. Regarding the perplexing expressions we often find in books of Kabbalah, and some that are even foreign to the human spirit. It is because once they have chosen this language to express themselves, namely the language of the branches, they could no longer leave a branch unused because of its inferior degree. They could not avoid using it to express the desired concept, when our world suggests no other branch to be taken in its place. Just as two hairs do not feed off the same foramen, so we do not have two branches that relate to the same shoresh. It is also impossible to exterminate the object in the wisdom that is related to that inferior expression. Such a loss would inflict impairment and confusion in the entire realm of the wisdom, since there is not another wisdom in the world where matters are so intermingled through cause and effect, cause and consequence. In the wisdom of Kabbalah, matters are connected and tied from top to bottom like a single long chain. Thus, there is no freedom of will here to switch and replace the bad names with better ones. We must always provide the exact branch that points to its upper shoresh and elaborate on it until the accurate definition is provided for the scrutinizing reader. Indeed, those whose eyes have been opened to the sights of heaven and have not acquired the proficiency in the connections of the branches of this world with their roots in the upper worlds are like the blind scraping the walls. They will not understand the true meaning of even a single word, for each word is a branch that relates to its shoresh. Only if they receive an interpretation from a genuine sage who makes himself available to explain it in the spoken language, which is necessarily like translating from one language to another, meaning from the language of the branches to the spoken language. Only then he will be able to explain the spiritual term as it is. This is what I have trouble to do in this interpretation. To explain the Esser Sephirot as the godly sage, the Ari, had instructed us in their spiritual purity, devoid of any tangible terms. Thus, any novice may approach the wisdom without failing in any materialization and mistake. With the understanding of these Esser Sephirot, one will come to examine and know how to comprehend the other issues in this wisdom. I'm sure you have questions from what I just read. The language of branches has a shorish. Each shorish has a branch. They're connected one to one. So when we say grass, we are describing in the language of branches the grass that's growing outside my window. But that's not what the language of branches is referring to. Grass acts as a ground cover. Grass acts as a green photosynthesis tool. Grass acts as going against gravity. Grass acts in innumerable other ways. So that when we say grass, we in our physical world, grass can have all of these different aspects connected into one thing. But in the upper worlds, in the shoresh, each of those four things I mentioned has its own shoresh. But when I say grass, we are talking about all four of those shoreshes in the spiritual frame. What is the purpose of ground cover? What is the purpose of photosynthesis? What is the purpose of going against gravity? And I forget what the fourth thing I said was. Ultimately, I'm sorry? Ground, no, I said ground cover. Something else. But ultimately, when the Kabbalist speaks of a word, and everybody thinks they understand it, they think in terms of physical things. And that's not what the Kabbalist is saying. And that's what Rabbi Ashlag is going to give us in this commentary. The understanding, the definitions, until it is absolutely clear what is the word that is being used. The language of branches is a language so exact, it's exactly what mathematics no longer provides for the scientific world. Mathematics is very clear. E equals mc squared. We know what E means. We know what M means. We know what C means. We know what squared means. It is very exact. But as we've gone into the quantum levels, that exactness has become problematic. And scientists, physicists, are running out of language, mathematics, the ability to describe what can't be measured. Whereas the language of branches developed by the Kabbalists is very clear. Now there is one paragraph here that applies to everyone, and that people don't realize the truth of this statement. And I'm going to reread it and then make a comment about it. Indeed, those who have eyes have not been opened to the sights of heaven. Excuse me. Indeed, those whose eyes have not been opened to the sights of heaven and have not acquired the proficiency in the connection of the branches of this world with their roots in the upper worlds are like the blind scraping the walls. They will not understand the true meaning of even a single word, for each word is a branch that relates to its shoresh. This also applies to psychic developments. People sense psychic attitudes. We have the sense to know what's going on in the world above us, called Yetzirah. We live in the world of action. The world of formation is above us. What happens in the world of formation causes everything that happens in our physical world. There are people developing this inner sense. They're sensing what's going on, but they don't have a language to describe it. And that lack of language means they're just the blind leaning against the wall. It is only through the language of branches, the language of the Kabbalah, that the ability to perceive and know what's going on in the world of formation. It's only through that technique and those tools that it all happens. Does anybody have any questions before I go on?
Question, yeah.
Bob is asking a question, so please speak up, Bob.
When would we learn more about the vocabulary of the branches and all the definitions of the terms?
That's what we're studying.
Okay, in chapter 1 or 2?
Forever. Okay. It's... I'll read this first spare section, and you'll understand. Are there any other questions?
That was good.
Glad you enjoyed it, Chris. Chapter 1. The chapter we just read, and we're just going to talk about Rabbi Ashlag's commentary about Chapter 1. One of the aspects of studying 10 luminous emanations is you study it over and over and over. Because you've read it the first time, you absorbed whatever you absorb, but it's not complete. And then you read Rabbi Ashlag's commentary, and then you go back and study it again with it, and you'll have a different understanding. And then you read Rabbi Ashlag's commentary again, and then go back and you'll have a different understanding from the first two. Know that before the Netzalim were emanated and the creatures created, an upper simple Or had filled the entire reality. These words require explaining. How is there a reality that the Or Pashut, the simple light, had filled before the Olamot, the worlds, were emanated? Also, the issue of the appearance of the will for the Tzimtzum in order to bring the perfection of his deeds to light, as it is implied in the book, means that there was already some want there, some desire. The issue of the middle point in him, where the Tzimtzum occurred, is also quite perplexing, for we have already said that there is neither head nor end there. So how is there a middle? Indeed, these words are deeper than the sea, and I must therefore elaborate on their interpretation. He's explaining these words. He's just said, right now, you think you understand the middle.
They're deeper than the sea.
But how can there be a middle if there's no head and there's no end? There's no beginning, there's no end. How can there be a middle? A simple question that we don't, it doesn't occur to us when we're reading it. Because we, in our ignorance and in our ego, think we understand the word middle. And that's, it's not an attack on everybody. This is humanity. There is not
the
entire reality that is not contained in En Sof. The contradicting terms in our world are contained in him in the form of he is one and his name one. This phrase is a famous phrase in our prayers in Hebrew. He is one and his name is one. This is describing, in the language of branches, this is describing the unity between the light and the vessel, between the desire of the vessel and the fulfillment that the light represents. Spirituality, fulfillment, sharing, is the opposite of receiving, desire. So how can they be in unity? By definition and understanding of the spiritual worlds, they should be at opposite sides of the universe. They're exactly opposite of each other. Yet we are saying they're in unity. This is the paradox expressed in this phrase, this language of branches. Now we can understand what a paradox is, but a paradox can never be rationalized. It can only be intuited. Number one, know that there is not an essence of a single being in the world. Both the ones perceived by our senses and the ones perceived by our mind's eye, that is not included in the Creator, for they all come to us from Him. Can one give that which is not inside one? The question being asked here is, we have an assumption that can never be proved in Kabbalah that the Creator is good. It can be experienced, it can be intuited, but we can't prove it logically. And the question is, if the Creator is good, there's no desire in Him. He is only sharing. And yet, how can He give something that isn't in Him? We can only give what we've already received. We can only share what we have learned. How can the Creator, who is only sharing, create something that has a desire? Us, in effect. This is the question, this is the paradox. This matter has already been thoroughly explained in the books. We must see that these concepts are separated or opposite for us. For example, the term chokhmah, wisdom, is regarded as different from the term sweetness. Chokhmah and sweetness, wisdom and sweetness, are two separate terms from one another. Similarly, the term operator certainly differs from the term operation. The operator and its operation are necessarily two separate concepts. And moreover, with opposite terms, such as sweet and bitter, these are certainly examined separately. However, in him, Chokhmah wisdom, pleasure, sweetness, and acrimoniousness, operation and operator, and other such different and opposite forms are all contained as one in his or Pashut, in his simple light. There are no differentiations among them whatsoever, as in the term one, unique, and unified. Rabbi Ashlag is now going to explain how one, unique, and unified, three different words, three different meanings, are all the same. He's also trying to express to us this paradox. There's a story about Rabbi Ashlag that who was diabetic, so he couldn't have sugar in his tea, and he loved tea, and tea without sugar is kind of bland. And he used to sit in front of his students, take the glass of tea in his right hand and the sugar in his left hand. And he would take a sip of tea, he would look at the sugar, he would take a sip of tea, and then he would say, no, it's too sweet. And he would break the sugar in half, the sugar cube in half, and then he would look at the half that he had in his hand, take another sip of tea, and say, yes, it's now just right. And every sip of tea, he would look at the sugar. Was he playing? Or was he unifying his innate energy, his innate being? His taste buds, the tea and the sugar, are using different taste buds, on our tongue. But in our mouth, they become unified. I'm continuing to read. However, in him, one indicates a single evenness. Unique implies that everything that extends from him, all these multiplicities, are in him as single as his atzmut. Unified shows that although he performs multiple acts, there is still one force that performs all these, and they all return and unite as one. Indeed, this one form swallows all the forms that appear in his operations. This is a very subtle matter, and not every mind can tolerate it. The Ramban has already explained to us the matter of his uniqueness as expressed in the words one, unique, and unified. When Rabbi Ashlag is saying not every mind can tolerate it, there are people in this world that find it impossible to study Kabbalah. They find it impossible to read the Zohar. In my own experience, I'm friends with a Talmud master, a Talmud Chacham. Literally, he knows Talmud backward and forward. He teaches Talmud in a university. He is very involved with Talmud. Earlier in his career, he made the effort to study Zohar. And he read it, and he couldn't understand it. And he left it. My teacher, one of my teachers, talked about a session where he was allowed into the classes that the last living Kabbalist, who passed about 5 years ago, I'm trying to remember his name. When I say the last living Kabbalists, I'm talking about the revealed ones. Today there are people calling themselves Kabbalists. They may or may not be Kabbalists, but the yeshiva that this class was given at, the gentleman was 108 years old. And when he passed, and he passed out of shock, or so it would appear, the Kabbalist would never be shocked. But he had designated his student to be his successor, rather not his children, but his student. His student was 54 years old, and he passed prior to the teacher by having a heart attack. And the teacher then passed almost immediately. He was hospitalized. He was well known. All kinds of prophecies are attributed to him. But my teacher was telling me about the class he attended. And my teacher's teacher was a student of this person. I'm sorry for not remembering his name. It'll come to me eventually. My teacher's teacher told him, you can go to this class, but you may not ask a question. You may not say a word. Do not say a word in this class. And my teacher described what took place in these classes every day. The two men, the student and the master, the student would read from the Etz Chaim, and somebody would ask a question, and the master would say, page so-and-so, one or two words, that's your answer. There was an incident or a series of questions by this one person. They were logical questions. My teacher said they made perfect sense to him. That whatever the subject being discussed, he asked a question, he was told to look at this page with these words as his answer. And he didn't understand. So he asked a follow-up question. And the teacher gave him a different page and a different couple of words. And he looked, and again, he didn't understand. So he had asked a second follow-up question. At which point the master said, you're no longer welcome in this class. What is the real issue there? Let's assume that the master was not coming from ego, because a Kabbalist should never come from ego, and I don't believe they do. So what is he doing? What is best for this student? This student is demonstrating that he is looking to understand Kabbalah logically. It can never be understood logically. And that's the message from my teacher's teacher to him. Because he would have asked a logical question. And that's the reason he was given permission to see this class. And that's the reason that my teacher told me this story. And the same reason that I am telling it to you. If you're coming from a frame of logic, it will not happen. We have to understand things intuitively. And that is what the letters that I've taught you in the basic classes help you achieve. Continuing. In his interpretation to the Sefer Yetzirah, He explains the difference between one unique and unified when he unites to act with one force. He is called unified. When he divides to act his act, each part of him is called unique. And when he is in a single evenness, he is called one. Thus far, his pure words. Just for the record, the Mishnah that we discussed in our Sefer Yetzirah class, the first class, Sefar Sipur, something else, but the three words that are spelled with Samach Pei Resh, which is the Shoresh for Sefirah. This is what is being translated here as one unique and unified. And if we were to go back to the Sefer Sefirah and read that first Mishnah with that translation, we'd have a whole different perspective. Now, the purposes of meditation, that wasn't true, but for the purposes of this study, we do need to understand this. Excuse me, we do need to intuit this. We are now being given a definition of one, unique and unified. When he unites to act with one force, he is called unified. There was an earthquake, one force, unified. The earth pushed against each other, and one went up, one went down, unified. When he divides to act his act, each part of him is called unique. The earth pulled up and created movement in the water, became a tsunami. This tsunami is unique. The earthquake is unique. They're two different acts. One cause, two different effects. But they are also causes on their own. And when he is in a single evenness, he is called one. Where is a single evenness? You will never find this in our physical world. But in the spiritual world, in your mind's eye, you will see the closest level to that is the feeling of serenity. There's no need to move. There's no need to do anything. There's just complete fulfillment in the feeling of serenity. That is the closest we get in our physical world to this oneness in the Ein Sof. I'm continuing. By saying unites to act with one force, he wishes to say that he works to bestow as worthy of his oneness, and his operations are unchanging. When he divides to act his act, meaning when his operations differ, and he seems to be doing good and bad, then he is called unique. Because all his different operations have a single outcome, good. We find that he is unique in every single act and does not change by his various operations. When he is in a single evenness, he is called one. One points to his essence, Atzmut, where all the opposites are in a single evenness. It is as the Rambam wrote, in him, knower, known, and knowledge are one. For his thoughts are far higher than our thoughts, and his ways higher than our ways. The knower is an entity. The known is revealed. And knowledge is the utilization of what is known by the knower. They're clearly three different things. But they're all one. Starting with all three things. In the light, in the endless world, is everything. All these different issues of separation, known, knower, knowledge, are light. They're even light. There's no separation in the light. White light goes through a prism. It comes out in seven colors. In the white light, all the seven colors existed. But they weren't seven colors. They were white light. How do we make use of this information in our life, in our world? When you see another person, in the back of your mind, yes, we live in this physical world. You see another person and he is separated from you by 3 feet, by 5 feet, by 13,000 miles. You see this other person, but in the back of your mind, you know he is you. You can look at your hand and see five fingers, or you can look at your hand and see one hand. What is the difference? The contemplation of that question is your homework. The contemplation of that question is what will cause you to enhance your intuition. Does anybody have any questions?
Where can we find this reading on your site?
Say again?
Where is this reading on your website?
It's not on my website. It's on the B'nai Baruch website. Go to Kabbalah.info. On the left of that link, when you get to that page, towards the bottom, there's a whole list of items. And the second to the last one is library, archive library, something like that. When you click on that, you have a whole list of items. One of which, the second one, is the Baal HaSulam, which is Rabbi Ashlag. You click on that, and then you see a list of all of his writings that have been translated into English by the B'nai Baruch group. And towards the bottom, you'll see Talmud Esther Sefirot. If you click on that, you'll see part 1, 2, 3, and through 8 and 16. So we're in part 1, And part one breaks out into Tzimtzum and Kav, chapter one, chapter two, and the Istakut Penimut, which is where I just finished reading. And then the rest of the section of part one is a test. It's really how well do you understand this material? Because in order to go on, you need to know the definitions of these terms. They need to be part of you so that when you see them, you know what he's saying. Just for the record, the Kabbalah Center never asked you to take that test. They just moved on, whether you knew it or not. I haven't decided whether I'm going to ask you to take the test or not, but we'll make that decision when we get further down. I have never taken the test, and I probably should. But I highly recommend that you take a look at the website, this material. It is a translation of Rabbi Ashlag's Esther Sefirot, which is a re-editing of the Etz Chaim by the Ari. And it is much easier to understand than the Etz Chaim. Any other questions?
Rav Layton referred into his material that we needed to learn the language of the branches before we could continue on.
Which one?
Rav Layton. Ben Brook.
Yes, that is what he teaches, and that's why the tests are part of his documentation. I was just explaining about the Kabbalah Center because Marcia comes from that background. Any other questions? Classes tonight. I apologize for last night. There will be a class at 10 tonight, your time, on the third temple. And tomorrow night, the 10 o'clock class is about the Ari, the Hilulah for the Ari. So I would make that a priority. Are there any other questions? Marcia, are you using Wi-Fi?
I'm using whatever I'm normally hooked up to, yeah.
Okay. Because your picture, your video is not clear, as you can see. So
No, it never is.
It has something to do with the power of your Wi-Fi. If you hooked it up to a cord, it'd probably be clearer.
It looks like a screen door.
Yeah, it does.
I've cut the maximum cable I can get here. I don't understand it, but...
Well, there's a difference between Wi-Fi and the hard wire. That's the difference.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, have a beautiful evening, and hopefully we'll see you later.
See you at 10.